You know, yeah, it could be the end. Everything has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Ask any Greek philosopher. Beginning, a middle, and an end. And then it starts over. So maybe what's needed now is some sort of, I don't know, a letter-writing campaign, maybe some phone calls, a few contacts to our elected officials for what value they may be. And why don't we try and help those people? Why don't we? Look, here's the problem. Here's the problem with our society. Not only do you give up a little bit of individual liberty for the convenience of the civilization, but I think as the civilization gets bigger, you give up even more of your individuality until you're convinced that somewhere, somebody is doing something about these problems that everyone's aware of, but don't seem to get solved. All right, let's just think about it and figure out if there's something we can do to justify our existence here on the planet while the whole bloody thing tries to go down, the drain. We'll be right back with David Bloom. He is a rational man, and not only that, he has some ideas on alternative energy. I think we probably better get about finding some. This is Coast to Coast AM. David Bloom is the executive director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture and the author of Alcohol Can Be a Gas. His website is alcoholcanbeagas.com. He's the leading advocate for alcohol fuel and the role of the American farmer in developing a truly sustainable energy and food policy for the post-oil era. Welcome, Mr. Bloom.
Well, good evening, John. I'm really glad to be here.
Good to have you. So, I take it when you're confronted with a disaster like this one that's ongoing, it occurs to you that prevention might be a really good idea rather than try and cure it.
Well, the cure is going to be a lot more work, of course, than preventing this. And, you know, this was not an unexpected accident, and it wasn't one that couldn't be analyzed in advance and be prepared for. But, you know, it's just the basic fundamental problem with nuclear power is that it is so touchy and so dangerous, and the results, if there's an accident, are so unbelievably bad that it's not worth the risk. Now, how did we get nuclear power? You know, it was primarily a function of our military. The Department of Energy used to be called the Atomic Energy Commission, and before it got modernized and included other energies. But the purpose was to provide nuclear material for our weapons program, and heat was the byproduct. And so they said, well, with all this heat, let's go ahead and make electricity with it by making steam. So people have frequently said that using nuclear energy to make steam is like the, you know, least intelligent way to boil water we've ever come up with. But
no kidding.
But the point was that wasn't the primary reason we built them. It was to have, you know, stuff for making bombs. So,
absolutely.
So acting as if nuclear power was an energy source, you know, has never really been part of the design, even though that's what's going on today, because nuclear war has become recognized as unwinnable if you start lobbing bombs around. So we're done with that. You know, we have 20, 30,000 weapons, and, you know, that's more than it would take to destroy the whole planet. So we don't really need to make any more nuclear weapon stuff. We should just own up to it and shut these things down. Now, that's not going to get rid of the problem, unfortunately, because all this fuel has to get stored somewhere, and it's going to be radioactive, well, for a minimum of 250,000 years, and some of the components will still be radioactive in 4.5 billion years, which is about the time the sun burns out. So we'll have other problems at that point to worry about. But, you know, how long is our memory? How long can we keep track of things? Some of the listeners may remember Love Canal, a place up in upstate New York there, or mid-state New York, and basically they buried average everyday toxic waste there, not even nuclear waste, and then covered it over, and then within, you know, a relatively small number of years, forgot it was there and built houses over the top of it. And everybody got sick, and they had to abandon the housing development because everybody was getting unusual cancers and all kind of stuff. So if we can't even keep track of something for 20 or 30 years, how are we going to keep track of it for 250,000? And that's the question the nuclear industry can never answer. What do we do with the waste when they're done?
You know, I sure hope the progression of humanity and humankind isn't sort of like getting a black belt in the martial arts, where you start off with white belt and then yellow and various colors, but you always begin your form from the beginning. So by the end of your career, you've done your white belt form many more times than your black belt form. And I just wonder if civilizations just build themselves up until, because it's obvious that this, we've had two or three major, totally global dispensations of anything that apparently wasn't intended to survive. And I'm just wondering if it's just that compulsive, Wells's theory of compulsory collapse. You just keep improving it until you can't improve it anymore, because now you're at a point. You can't go up any higher, and you also can't get down. So it just all falls down. And I mean, it looks to me like nuclear power, given the behavior of the Earth, given the density of the population, and given the demands by this increasing population, which is now up to 7 billion people across the world.
I remember when I was a kid, it was only 2 and 3 billion, you know, and my gosh,
yeah,
it's gone up fast.
Yeah, when you think about it, we're 330 million people here.
And
out of 7 billion.
Yeah.
Out of 7 billion. That's not very many people here in the United States. And I'm
no,
just...
We're a flea on the belly of the dog here.
Well, looking down the road... David,
the
people in the developing world, they need power too. Isn't nuclear power the one that everybody's going to reach for? Isn't that the only way to give them power? And once we do, won't we go up to 8 billion in short order? I mean, is there some culling of the herd here that's written in a book somewhere that we don't know about?
Gosh, you know, there's a lot of ways to answer these questions, John. But, you know, I am basically a pretty hopeful person because as an ecologist, I'm the guy who studies the relationship between things in nature. And so, yes, nuclear power is not natural, but we humans have an ecology, and to some degree it resembles the ecology in other populations. I personally don't think the population of humanity is going to level out before 10 billion. So we have, you know, a lot of momentum that we have to slow down over the next generation or two to get to a place where we're not growing our population anymore. And that's with some concerted effort and, you know, hopefully education. Now, you know, I also am really hopeful because we're pretty clever monkeys, you know, and we know although we're really good at making deserts or trashing the ocean as we're doing with Fukushima and making these colossal blunders, we are also very sharp when it comes to solving things. And I'm not talking about the new whiz-bang technology that's supposed to save us. I'm talking about really basic things that when people really are faced with a challenge, creativity steps up and common sense, which is anything but common, starts to prevail. And we actually have been able to accomplish many things. I mean, I would look at, for instance, the United States. Back during the Dust Bowl years in the 30s, where we completely ruined our agriculture and the topsoil was literally blowing away and no one was doing anything about it until a dust storm from the Midwest turned Washington completely black for a day, and then the politicians noticed. And since then, we've done a tremendously positive job on figuring out how we do things properly in agriculture, conserving our soil. We don't burn off crops anymore. We've learned a lot in a relatively short number of decades, which allow us to produce an enormous amount of food. You know, does it feed the world? No, because we get in the economic systems, which separate the haves from those who don't, and we end up feeding our corn, you know, which we grow, you know, billions of bushels a year, to cattle, because we can afford to. But when we feed it to cows, you know, they eat 10 pounds of corn to make 1 pound of beef in round numbers. Well, if we fed that corn to people around the world, there'd be no hunger, but we'd have less meat. Well,
right.
we, Or would we? You know, we can be smarter than we are now. We feed that corn to cows because it has protein in it. And that's what we want to make with cows is a lot of protein.
Sure.
But the rest of it goes to waste. You know, cows can't even digest the 70% of corn that's starch because, well, quite frankly, cows didn't evolve eating corn and grains. They evolved in the forests of Europe and North Africa where they ate woody brush. So, you know, here we are feeding starch to cows that can't digest it. And, you know, that 10 pounds that went in and 9 pounds obviously come out. If you only get 1 pound a cow, most right. of that is starch. So if we take the starch out first, like we do when we make alcohol, and then feed the byproduct to the cattle, well, guess what? We actually get just as much or even more meat than if we fed the whole corn to the cow. So when we do something intelligent like, you know, pull the starch out the cows aren't digesting first, make fuel with it, we can do a very clever thing. We can use that to replace our fossil fuels and still feed just as many people as we did before, or in this case, cows, which, you know, become food for people who aren't vegetarians. So, you know, so we can do things that are very intelligent, and it's amazing how we can work with nature instead of against it. Bucky Fuller used to say, nature is trying very hard to help us survive, but we are not the only experiment. So, you know, if we keep avoiding the lessons that nature gives us about abundance, we can go ahead and drive ourselves into extinction if we really work at it, but we don't have to do that. And going to renewable energy is a very, very important step in our evolution.
Now, your focus is alcohol, yes? Alcoholisagas.com.
Absolutely, because alcohol can be used for so many things that we are running out of. Let's say electricity, for instance. I'm working on projects right now in Central America, and also I just came back from the Philippines, where there's a big shortage of electricity, and they're using diesel fuel in generators to make electricity in many of these places. So a lot of the world is not using nuclear or coal, which are both horrendous fuels. They're using bunker oil, the worst kind of diesel you can get, and yes. It's costing them 30 cents, 40 cents a kilowatt for power. And here in the United States, because we have so much renewable energy, we have hydroelectric, we have, you know, all that incredible stuff we built back in the 40s, you know, with tax money, we're able to go ahead and actually keep our power down around, you know, 12 cents a kilowatt, which wouldn't be that high if we weren't using things like nuclear power, which is very expensive. So alcohol can produce electricity at about 8, 9, 10 cents a gallon, a kilowatt. So it's much cheaper than the way a lot of the world makes fuel right now. I mean, you have countries like Ethiopia that we just were awarded a UN contract to put an alcohol plant in a village there for an experiment to show this. And basically, the situation in Ethiopia is 60% of the population centers, villages, towns, et cetera, don't even have a road to them. There's no grid in the entire country, and there's over 100 million people there, like a third of the United States. No grid, no roads. So how are you going to get electricity to people? Well, you have to produce it on site in a decentralized way. Well, heck, what's decentralized? Well, solar energy is decentralized. It falls everywhere, you know?
Oh, yes.
Well, you know, alcohol is solar energy because when plants take in the sun in photosynthesis, they also take in carbon dioxide out of the air, which is, you know, what we want to do. We want to reduce the carbon dioxide in the air, and water. So they make carbohydrates. Well, that's kind of obvious. Carbon dioxide, hydrate, water. It's all glued together with sunlight. When we make alcohol, we ferment those carbohydrates, and we make basically wine or beer, you know, in a funky way. And then we go ahead and distill it to basically high-proof whiskey. And that's the fuel we need. We can use that in cars. We can use it for heating. We can use it for lighting. We can use it for electrical generation. And in places like Ethiopia, you know, what we use alcohol for is to replace wood for cooking. because you were mentioning earlier the population being up to 7 billion now. Well, 3 billion people on the planet cook with wood every day, which means
that's got to contribute to global warming just a little bit.
Just a little bit. Not only are, you know, so they're removing the very engines of removal of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere. Remember that photosynthesis again.
Right.
So with 3 billion people out there, and you can't hardly blame people for wanting to cook their food. I mean, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. But the problem is, it's extremely toxic. It's the largest killer of children in the developing world, wood smoke in the home.
I believe it.
Yeah, it's obstructive pulmonary disease, it's eye injuries, it's emphysema. And let's talk about the women of the world, 2 million of them a year, million of them a year dying from cooking food for their family because they're sitting there over that wood smoke all day. So with alcohol burns very, very clean, not just in stoves like this where you can be completely in a closed up room in and cook with alcohol and it's not toxic and it won't kill you. But it has that same effect when we run it in a car. It's over 98% cleaner than gasoline because alcohol is a single substance that is full of oxygen, unlike a hydrocarbon, which is what gasoline is. It only has hydrogen and carbon in it. It needs oxygen from the air to burn. When we burn alcohol, we pretty much get carbon dioxide and water in the either out of the stove or in the exhaust of the car. And that's the same thing you and I are breathing out. So it's a non-toxic fuel. Well, there are some mornings after drinking alcohol. I wouldn't attest
right.
to that. But, you know, other than that, it's edible. You know, it's biodegradable if it drops into the ocean, unlike the BP disaster, you know, which we've talked about on this station. The, alcohol in the ocean just makes fish a little drunk and big deal. You know?
Yeah, I'll tell you, the yellow jackets like it. They'll go up there and get that fermented fruit, and they're lying around on the ground. They can't even stand
anymore.
They're all
drunk. And the robins, you know, they go after those red pyracantha berries that have been fermenting, and they fly all crooked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's not poisonous, you know. Now, you look at nuclear power. You know, one of the things we say in ecology is you don't use resources that destroy your basic ability to produce. In other
right.
words, you might use something that runs out. That's not so good either. That's like oil. Or
sure.
you might use something that, if you don't use it, it goes to waste. Like apples on a tree. If you don't eat them, they just fall on the ground and rot, right?
Yeah.
So you don't hurt the apple tree by using the apples. You know, or if something, it doesn't matter if you use it or not, like wind power. That wind's blowing whether or not you go ahead and, you know, use it. So we have different kinds of energy that we can choose to use. But the absolute no-no is using something that destroys other things in its use. So coal, you know, we go ahead and burn coal, puts mercury into the air, it falls into the ocean, goes up the food chain, and now you can't eat all those resources, all that fish. So between coal and nuclear, you know, we are violating the basic rules of good energy production.
Understood and appreciated. We will continue our most singular discussion on the Fukushima Forum, which includes alternatives to the energy source that resulted in the Fukushima problem. Someone suggested, should it be Fukushima Forum or Fukushima FUBAR? Yes, it is fouled up beyond all recognition. However, with any luck, it won't go to Fukushima FUBACOR, which is fouled up beyond any chance of recovery. You got me? I know you do. John Wells sitting in with you tonight. We'll be back. This is Coast to Coast AM. Our Fukushima Forum tonight. We are currently talking with Mr. David Bloom. He is the Executive Director of the International Institute for Ecological Agriculture. His website is alcoholcanbeagas.com. We need some new ideas. No way. And he has some, and we'll continue with the final segment for this hour with David Bloom in just a moment. Just 2 minutes, please. Stand by. This is Coast to Coast AM. David Bloom, I understand now alcohol can be made from just about anything. We mentioned corn repeatedly, but we did not mention anything else that it might be made from. Could we sort of do a, almost a Mr. Fusion from Back to the Future, where we just throw your potatoes and your French fries in there and kind of get it going on. I've been hearing about this renewable energy. That's a term that's annoyed me forever. Renewable sources of energy, I think, or renewable energy. I'm not really there, but that's just semantics.
Well, let's look at potatoes, right? I mean, right? Just talk about French fries. So when they make French fries, they peel all the potatoes, and they have truckloads of potato waste. So some of my students have, offered to haul away that waste a little less expensively than the guys who are hauling it now. I mean, why do it for free if you can make a little on it? And, you know, what is potatoes, you know, when they're fermented and distilled? Well, they're vodka, of course.
I'm going to ask any Russian.
Yeah. Well, Russians drink almost anything. For instance, in Russia, they still make alcohol for one of my favorite crops, which are cattails. Now, cattails aren't usually thought of as a crop, John. I mean, they're the stick with the hot dog you see in marshes and wet spots by the side of the road.
Sure.
Those plants are loaded with starch, and they can be made into an enormous amount of alcohol, 20 times as much as corn per acre.
So, make sake out of rice.
Yeah, rice is equal to corn, you know, in terms of alcohol per acre. Although rice is really a staple food for humans, where corn is really just cattle feed in the United States. So feeding the byproduct of the cattle is fine for corn. But we could, for instance, look at beets. You know, in the northern U.S., we can grow fodder beets, which are like sugar beets, but even bigger. They're like 15 pounds a piece. And they produce, again, four times as much alcohol as corn and twice as much animal feed. So there's a million things we can make alcohol from. Well, literally a million food processing plants in the United States that produce huge quantities of waste. Like one of my students lived near a Pez candy factory. You know, the little Pez dispensed candies, little bricks of sugar.
Sure.
Well, they break a lot of those when they make them. They threw away 20,000 pounds a week.
Is that all?
You know, that's a lot of alcohol you can ferment from all that sugar.
Amazing.
I was just in the Philippines where this one port was shipping 1 million pounds of bananas a day from 1.2 million acres of bananas, which was a tiny fraction of this land in the southern Philippines. But a third of all the bananas are thrown away because they're too small. So
a third are thrown away.
That's right. In other words, you see a big bunch of bananas, the two and sometimes three top bunches are big enough for Europeans and Americans to eat. And then the bottom ones they call pig bananas because they're only, you know, they're not fully developed. They're only 3 inches, 4 inches long. Those can all be made into alcohol because bananas are starch and sugar. So we have enormous surpluses of waste that could make a big dent in the world energy needs, especially outside the United States. And we could certainly replace all the liquid fuel we use in the United States and all the electricity we make from nuclear and coal. We absolutely can do that because the amount of sunlight and plants that we can produce in this beautiful, enormous country we have is more than up to the job of replacing all the oil that we currently use.
Then we could do all the heavy breathing that we want because that'll make carbon dioxide. We won't have to pay a carbon tax, and the plants will like it, and they'll put back oxygen. It'll be great. Now, let me ask you this.
Yeah.
I'm being slightly facetious, but it could happen. Is there a major movement to get this going on, or is Mother Nature going to have to hold a gun to our heads and go, look, fools, you see what you've done with this nuclear stuff? Now, before the last of you just turn green and pop right out there on the scorched, once beautiful plain, get with an alternative energy source at once. I mean, is this going to happen without duress from Earth?
Well, it's not the Earth. The Earth is already complaining about, our fouling the air and water and, our oceans. I mean, in the Philippines when I was there, it was like a paradise, but I got on a boat, went out and checked this river out. It was the color of a cafe mocha, you know, and for those of you who don't go to Starbucks, that's pretty dark with a lot of white milky stuff in it. And that was sewage, okay, in this river.
Yeah.
And then
I thought that's where you were headed.
Oh, yeah, a city of 4 million, no sewage treatment plant. The next river it joined was dirtier and bigger, and then it went into the bay at this place, into the salt water. Now, as an ecologist, what would I do about that level of destruction? Well, I said to the Philippine government and industrialists I was taking on this river, that I said, you're so lucky. Look at all these free nutrients and fertilizer. Now you have to go ahead and use those and get them out of the river where they don't do any good. So it turns out there's all these abandoned shrimp and fish farms all along the river. And if they ran some of that polluted river water into the fish farm, big ponds basically, and grew cattails in those, they could get 7,000 gallons of alcohol per acre, and the water coming out of the fish ponds would be cleaned up. All the nutrients would be pulled out. And then the nutrients going into the bay, we could, like the Chinese already do for food, they spread nets and grow marine algae. This algae grows like 18 inches a day. They cut 10 feet a week off the nets, and that'll produce more than the cattails. And it cleans up the ocean while bubbling oxygen into the ocean, because they're plants. Plants give off oxygen. Yep. And we could make a lot of money off all this, and that's when the lights went on.
How long is it going to take for enough people to get with a program that this makes an impact?
Well, all it takes is for a few people to make money doing it, and then everybody follows, right? So this is already starting to happen around the world. So let's look at Brazil. Brazil doesn't use any imported oil anymore for gasoline or diesel, period. All of the fuel that they're using in Brazil is made in the country, and most of it is alcohol. So here's a huge country. I mean, for those of you who haven't looked at a map in a while, Brazil is like the fourth or fifth biggest country in the world, and they are off of oil. They don't have to import any oil. They have a little of their own, but they don't have to import oil. How would that affect us if we weren't importing oil anymore?
Well, there'd be a lot of really angry people in the oil business.
I can't say that on the radio, but tough. Okay.
Yes, you can. David will bleep it out if it's too strong.
All right. So basically, you know, those guys had their chance to convert to the right thing. They blew it, so it's up to us. See, the thing about making alcohol is all of us can do it. There's nothing patentable about making alcohol. It's, you know, it's mankind's second oldest profession. It's, you know, it's not complicated. I mean, yeast do all the work. We just separate the alcohol from the water with a distillery. I mean, if you look at those guys in Tennessee, you can look at them and say, I'm as smart as that. You know, I can do it too. And you can do it on a scale that's, you know, neighborhood or town or even village in Africa, which is where we're just sending this still right now for the UN. So we can do this as a business here too. I mean, just think about it for a minute. If you go down to the local bakery and get their 60 tons of wheat of waste dough, or the donut shops in your neighborhood, and convert those to alcohol, and it costs you maybe 30 cents a gallon, and gasoline is selling for $4. Well, at least in California, it's selling for more than that. But, you know, that's where it's going. If it's not there in your town already, there's a little margin there. You can make a nice living on making 100,000 gallons a year.
I sense the approach of political opposition already when you mentioned 30 cents a gallon.
Well, you know, political opposition is one thing, but none of that has stopped moonshining in the last 200 years, right?
So, well, the government would make money. We'd all have to get a permit to distill alcohol at our homes, and so they'd be happy with the permit money.
But guess what? The permit is free of charge and allows you to make up to 5,000 gallons of alcohol for yourself right now. We already fought that battle in the 80s, and that the three people at the three persons at the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms, when you call them up, they go, oh, you're calling because you read Dave Bloom's book. Well, no problem. We'll send you a permit. I mean,
really?
They're really nice people, you know? I mean, the government isn't full of all dunderheads. I mean, you know, these guys are happy to have a job, and processing our permits is good for them. So, and going into the business of making the larger amount might cost you a couple of $1,000 for a bond, but otherwise the permit's free. So we fought these battles for renewable energy back during the oil crises of the late 70s, early 80s. So we're, as Americans, allowed to make alcohol now for fuel with almost no restrictions. The permit's only 2 pages long. So we can do this, and we can do this in our communities, and each of our communities can become energy sovereign. We don't need to buy oil. And we don't need to export the capital out of our community to pay for that oil, because if we make it in our community, that money circulates around the community and makes everyone a little more prosperous. And I'd much rather give my money to a farmer who's making alcohol from, you know, sorghum or beets or whatever, than I would to send it to a transnational corporation who, frankly, doesn't care about my town. So, you know, it's something that we can do in a small business format, which actually gives us an advantage over the big alcohol plants and over oil companies, because we don't have to transport stuff, you know, hither and yon to make the fuel if we're doing it locally. We don't have to ship the liquid mash left over, you know, 50 miles back out to some sewage treatment plant.
That's right over there.
Yeah, we just use it right back on the land where it's fertilizer, you know, because it's not too much. See, too much is sometimes a problem in nature, you know, surpluses. Nature doesn't have those because it figures out how to reuse things pretty instantly. If you have a surplus, like too much manure at a feedlot, well, now you got problems, right? You got water pollution, you got work that you have to do, and I really hate extra work. So having to clean all this up with a loader, and then you got pollution, right? So, you know, an expense. So all that is much more expensive than providing decent feed for cattle in a more less intense situation. You actually make more money grass feeding cattle than you would feedlotting.
Now let me ask you this, David. Does a family, average family of four, put out enough? I mean, what are the calculations on how much alcohol would, if such a thing exists anymore, an average family, or let's just say an individual, since they vary and they come in so many different configurations now, really, other than the traditional one, what output of waste product is required to come up with enough material to make, enough alcohol to go for the year?
Well, you know, if you're talking about donuts, for instance, probably 10 pickup trucks would do it over the year. And I used to pull a pickup truck out every 2 days from a donut shop in San Francisco. So there's a lot of stuff you can use. And that's because donuts are, you know, basically wheat, starch, and sugar, you know.
Well, I guess what I'm asking is how much...
Can we make enough? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, can a family make enough to run their stuff on, or would they be highly restricted?
Well, think about it. Most people need 500 to 1,000 gallons to run their vehicle for the year. 1,000 if they're commuters, 500 if they're, you know, if they work locally.
Yep.
Then, of course, you need to make electricity, which alcohol can do as well. And, of course, you can also use alcohol in many parts of the country for heating your house. In other words, people who heat with fuel oil can now substitute that with alcohol and with only a couple of adjustments run their fuel oil on it. Now, so you might need a couple of thousand gallons a year. Well, if you have a small distillery, and we're starting to build these now because people have been asking us, and we used to teach people how to build their own, and we still do, and that's what my book, Alcohol Can Be a Gas, does. But people want to go into the small business of this, so maybe you don't do it for yourself. You do it for you and 10 neighbors. And now all you need is maybe 1,500 square feet, in other words, in the back of your barn if you're on a farm, to make enough alcohol for 10 people.
Let me ask you this, David.
It's more practical than doing it just for yourself. You know, I mean, we are a community here in this country. And if, you know, if somebody goes out there and makes alcohol, well, then let's support that person, you know.
Now, you're saying it burns very cleanly. Now, Wayne... Sorry about the throat clearing thing. It's humidity, and the humidity here produces spores, molds, fungus, and other unmentionables. What about the byproducts? Wayne says that the American Motorcycle Association, for example, outlawed running alcohol-fueled motorcycles in the Cow Palace over 40 years ago because burning alcohol in internal combustion engines forms aldehydes, including methanol and ethanol.
Well, actually, it's methanol that's the problem, because it makes certainly an aldehyde, which is called formaldehyde.
Right.
As we all know, formaldehyde is pretty toxic stuff. So ethanol, on the other hand, makes almost no aldehydes at all, but the small amount it makes are called acetaldehyde. And that is not hardly toxic at all, but it's in such tiny quantities that it's part of the 1% of emissions that are not completely removed by running alcohol. Remember, it's about 98% pollution-free typically.
Okay.
So they do exist, but they're very tiny. But the ones from methanol, which is the alcohol typically used in racing, is quite toxic. So there's a big difference between methanol, which is made from natural gas, and ethanol, which is made from plants. And then, you know, if you look at the next alcohol up the chemical table, that's isopropyl alcohol, and that's absolutely deadly if you take a sip of that. You know, and it makes not a very good fuel either. It makes a lot of nasty emissions. So each alcohol, you know, has to be examined independently, and ethanol, luckily, is the one we can drink and we can put in cars, and it's safe.
Is isopropyl alcohol, is that wood alcohol?
No, methanol is wood alcohol.
Oh, gotcha. Okay,
yeah,
sorry.
It used to be made by heating up wood without air, and the vapor that comes off would be largely methyl, you know, methyl alcohol.
I'll tell you, these humans are wacky, aren't they? They just play around with all kinds of things. Do you see a brighter future for alcohol than, say, hemp oil?
Well, you know, the trouble with hemp oil, it's not really usable as a fuel because it's too valuable. I mean, you know, fuel is cheap. You know, it's, you know, $1 a pound or something. But hemp oil is worth so much more because of all the important uses that it has, both nutritionally and as a high-temperature lubricant. And all, there's just a lot of things you can use hemp oil for, and all those are more valuable than fuel. So, you know, hemp oil, I doubt will ever produce enough of it to be used as a fuel other than as a novelty, because we have so many other petrochemicals we can replace with hemp oil and other vegetable oils.
Understood. Well, in the last remaining 2 minutes, tell our audience what to do, how to get involved, and how to move this agenda forward.
Well, the first thing you want to do is put alcohol in your car. And you say, well, wait a minute, I have a gasoline car. But you can run up to 50% in your car without modification. Go to our website, alcoholcanbeagas.com, and we have a station finder up in the right corner there, and you can find the closest alcohol station to you. There's over 2,500 now. Put a gallon in your tank, because that's a gallon you didn't give the money to the oil companies for. Next time, put in 2 gallons. And you can keep going until you get up to 50% or so.
That's several billion gallons across the nation.
That's 70 billion gallons if you do it, and that's, you know, that, and we only import 30% of our oil from the Middle East. So if we just get up to 30% alcohol, we've now eliminated the need to be in the Middle East. We don't have to spend tax dollars there anymore. We don't have to kill people or be killed there anymore. We can tell the, you know, OPEC countries, let's see if you can eat your oil because we're not buying it anymore. I mean,
wouldn't that be fun?
That would be great. You know, now we can do this around the whole world, and most of the rest of the world is going to alcohol. Only in the United States, because we're the biggest oil-using country, do the oil companies spend a lot of money to make sure we don't know that we can use it. But go to our website. You'll learn a lot about alcohol. And also, we are selling alcohol conversion kits there, which we're going to be giving a big discount to the first 50 people who want to get them from us. But and we do give them away at some of our drawings, too, if you get on our mailing list. But these kits allow you to run on alcohol or gas. You put whatever you want in the tank. The little computer that's part of this interacts with your car's computer and makes everything the right ratio of air and fuel in, et cetera. This technology is already on flex fuel vehicles that are available from all the major manufacturers. So this is, if you don't have a flexible vehicle already, you can make it into one.
And, excellent.
And so basically the answer is we need to stop using oil. It's the wrong stuff, and we can make it ourselves.
Fantastic to have you back on the show. I know you were with Ship's Captain George Norrie on March 29th, but you're the man, so that's why we had you come back. His book is Alcohol Can Be a Gas. His website is Alcohol Can Be a Gas. And he is David Bloom. On the other side of this top of the hour break, Dr. John Apsley, Fukushima Meltdown and Modern Radiation, Protecting Ourselves and Our Future Generations. This is Coast.